got your papers done. Whew, nice to get a stack out of the way. And so you can get them after class. They're in alphabetical order, so paw through and find yours. A few observations in general. Most of you did a pretty good job of getting the guts of Luther right and kind of getting to the whole idea of the crux telegorum. Did handle that pretty well. On the implications, some of you kind of were at a loss for what you're supposed to say. I kind of, at least that's my perception. I'm just guessing. But one of the things I would really stress is what comes through very clearly is that this is an example, again, kind of the whole crux telegorum of divine monergism, human responsibility. So evangelism, who's doing it? God. Who has to go out and proclaim? Me. And how well do I have to do my job? Really, really well. Yeah, but God's doing the converting. Yeah, but you're responsible. See what I mean? It's the crux telegorum all over again. So you can't kind of lay back and say, well, you know, conversion is God's problem. We just kind of wait for it to happen. And we'll talk to people as we can. No, it needs to be a little more aggressive. People are going to hell. You need to do something about it. But wait a minute. It's all God's choice. Yes, but it's also your responsibility. So it's that tension's there again. And you can even put it this way. No proclamation, no faith. And that's true. But you say, oh, but wait. God will get those he's chosen. Well, that's kind of almost irrelevant for us. For us, what matters is we've got to proclaim. And if we aren't proclaiming, people are going to hell. And can you even say to somebody, you know, if you never tell your neighbor about what Christ has done for them, and they end up in hell, you're responsible. Yeah, I think you can say that. I don't have a problem with that. And is that guilting somebody? Yeah. Yeah, okay. So, it's fine. The law does that to us. And so I don't have a big problem with that. So kind of the things, and a lot of you picked up on this, but the driving thing for me is if we take this thing seriously, well, then that means people who are dead. And until somebody tells them the gospel, they're still dead. So we've got to talk. And we've got to go out there and actually open our mouths and talk and do this. And this also kind of calls into question things like seeker-sensitive services. I mean, what is a seeker if you really take Luther seriously? There's no such thing. If you really take Luther seriously, there is no middle ground. You're either dead or you're alive, period. So then seekers are just idol worshipers looking for a new idol. That's all. And so maybe they're a little more spiritually inclined than some of the other pagans, but they're no more saved or not halfway saved, or they're not even more looking. They're just, you know, filling themselves with their new kind of idol. So we need to be honest about what we're really doing here and what, you know, kind of outreach really looks like and what is the goal. And the bottom line always has got to be no proclamation, no faith. The gospel needs to be proclaimed, which is one of the reasons why I hate that. St. Francis of Assisi quote, preach the gospel always, when necessary, use words. Hate it. Hate it. Because if you're not using words, you're not doing the gospel. You might be being nice. That's great. But you're not preaching the gospel until you actually open your mouth and talk about Jesus. It's got to happen. Somewhere, sometime, you've got to open your mouth. All right. Anything else then on that? Now that I've opened a can of worms, maybe. You guys are so bashful. So timid. All right. So today we have three things on the agenda. I want to get to two of the three at least. And so I want to bang through Pieper quickly, and I want to crank through Broughton, and then we'll see how much we get into Luther, and if not, we'll pick up Luther next time, because next time we just got a bunch of Pieper stuff, so we can always squeeze that down and get Luther in. So I do want to make sure I cover some of the stuff from the Great Galatians Commentary from Volume 26 that I had you read. So we'll cover that, but I'm not sure if we'll get to it today or not. We'll see how it goes. All right, so let's just get cranking along here. We got a fair amount of ground to cover, and frankly, the Broughton stuff we need to spend a little more time on because that's going to be a little less familiar to you and some of the things we're going to do there. That's fine. So with Pieper, we'll just kind of bang through this stuff. It's pretty straight up, not a lot of heavy-duty stuff. We're starting on page 503 with volume 2 again. We're back to volume 2, wrapping that up and hitting on the whole thing with justification a little bit more and just bringing out a few more of the terms and a few more of our definitions here that we need to make sure we get this right. So we'll just kind of rank through this quickly. Page 504, Pieper makes the point. This is the top paragraph, last part. Neither the good works of unbelievers, such as those of the Pharisees, nor the truly good works which flow from faith, such as those of faithful Abraham, can justify a man before God. Now, what's interesting here is what Pieper is doing is he's making this distinction between good works of the pagan and really good works. And he's even willing to call them good works, which is interesting because we have a pretty strong tradition of people being really reluctant to say, there no one can do any good work except for in Christ, which is true. But then we have the mistake that people make of starting to get really hung up on, well, it's a good work because you're doing it for Jesus. Wrong. Your motive does not make it a good work, ever. Motive has nothing to do with a good work. A good work is a good work for only one reason. Doesn't matter who's doing it. What makes it a good work is the fact that it is forgiven in Christ. That's what makes it a good work. So in other words, you offer up a deed, and if you're a sinner doing it, it's a sinful deed. So what does it need? It needs the forgiveness of Christ applied to it. Once Christ's forgiveness is applied, now it's a pleasing work to God. Then it makes it a good work. So the real difference between a good work of a pagan and the good work of a Christian is nothing to do with motive or heart or attitude, even though you hear this all the time. It really has to do with, is it forgiven or not? And if it's joined to Christ, it's forgiven. And you guys can come up here on the table. There's a couple spots here, you know, unless you like hanging back there. You probably like that, yeah. Separatist that you are. All right. Now, this really actually opens up an opportunity for me to lay out for you one more time if you haven't seen this before. What I would suggest is kind of a helpful way to think about this in context of our 2KR paradigm. You guys are very familiar with that. I have suggested that maybe we need to think about three kinds of righteousness. Luther even talks this way sometimes, and so does Melanchthon, interestingly, but that's not really relevant for us today. But if we think about it this way, we would think about the three kinds of righteousness laid out like this. You have the first kind of righteousness, which I will call governing. And then you have the second kind of righteousness, which would be justifying. And then you have the third kind of righteousness, which could be called sanctifying, though after my little diatribe last time, you know I'm not real fond of that word, sanctifying, anyway. But you might call this just, we'll call it holifying. Just to try to avoid sanctifying. But the idea of the good life we're living, being obedient. Now, this way of thinking about it is kind of interesting. If you haven't seen this, you know, if you didn't have any for Luther mind, you maybe have not seen this. But I want to suggest this as kind of a helpful way forward. We've already said that there is a connection, a nexus between the first and second kind of righteousness, which happens where? All right, exactly. Inside me, the believer. So I live at this nexus. Now, what's interesting about this paradigm is the first kind of righteousness then basically amounts to the righteousness of those who are living in the world, regardless they're standing before Christ. Because when they're living in the world, what is the norm of what is good and what is right, ultimately? Well, ultimately, what's really the norm? Natural law, all right? The whole idea of natural law. And natural law is really just a synonym for what, as far as I'm concerned? All right, God's will. God's will for creation. So that's what the natural law is God's will. So what happens is this. Think about it. A person living in the world, simply being a good person, is conforming to God's will for the way the world works. He's being just and upright and kind of things. And so he is actually conforming to the will of God, and that will of God is the natural law. And so as he adheres to it, that's the standard, that's the bar, and he's trying to reach for it and go for it. And as he does those things, is he doing good works? From the world standpoint, sure. And is it beneficial to the neighbor? Absolutely. And will I encourage those kinds of things? Well, yeah, I'll take it. It's great. Wonderful that he's doing these kinds of things. All right. Is that in any way salvific? No. Of course not. Of course not. Because no matter how hard he tries, he's still a sinner doing them, and he's always falling short, which is why it drives us ultimately to the second kind of righteousness. Very familiar with this. Passive righteousness, the righteousness of faith that comes in Christ. Christ gives us forgiveness of sins, and we have it. Right? Done deal. Coram Deo. Justitia of God, the righteousness of God, the justice of God, favor Dei propter Christum, got it all laid out. Then, once I'm justified, we already know this one from last discussion, what is my response as a Christian creature justified before God? Back out in the world, into my vocations, do what God gave me to do. And when I enter into that world and start doing what God gave me to do, what's my standard? What's the criteria for how I should live? God's will. In other words, natural law. And so, lo and behold, I'm striving for the same standard as the pagan, basically. So that's why the really good pagan and the really good Christian on the outside to the unbeliever looking in, they look no different. Their performance on the outside, very much the same. But there's a world of difference in that I know I'm justified before God, and I have a sense of where I stand before God, which is wonderful and freeing and tremendously liberating, but really doesn't make much difference at all in how I get out there and live, except, yeah, sometimes I'm motivated by that gospel explosion. And to be honest, I'm probably a little bit more tuned in to what God would have me do, and I'm paying a little more attention, but I don't have a different set of rules. When you become a Christian, God doesn't say, all right, now that you know, here's the secret list. Start doing this stuff. No, it's always the same. It's a matter of being obedient to what God calls us to do. So in a sense, this could be considered the three kinds of righteousness. And it's interesting how these also correspond to the three uses of the law, the curb, the mirror, and the guide. Okay, kind of interesting how that plays out. And you even talk about how the articles of the creed play into here a little bit, where you got the first article, world, the second article, proclamation, and the third article, the life of the Christian, getting out and doing what God gives us to do. Kind of interesting how these things play out. Yes, Anthony.
So once a person gets to the second and the third, do they ever go back to the first?
In one sense, there's really, and see, this also helps to clarify a little bit of the, our talk about third use of the law. Right. And people often say, there's no difference between the first and the third use. And there's there's something to be said for that. Because to me, the only real difference between the first and the third function of the law is that one is a Christian, the other one's a non-Christian. Because it's the same law I'm trying to do, and I'm trying to do it for the sake of my neighbor, and there's not that much difference. So in a sense, it's the same. But in another way, I'm willing to keep the discussion of the first function, because I think the first function gets more at the idea of just the kind of the normative curbing aspect of the law. And does that still work in the life of a Christian? I would say absolutely all the time, no problem. And while there are some who would say, yeah, it kind of does, and that's kind of too bad that we're not better motivated, my attitude is more, yeah, it does, fine. It has its place. And I'm glad it's there because it keeps me in check. Sometimes the law just holds me in from doing stupid things, and that's great. And the law has that role in my life, even as a Christian. Yeah, I'm still somebody who says that peccator, I need it. And maybe it's a little embarrassing to admit that, but that's the reality. So it has a role, I think, even for the believer. Okay? Anything else then? Yeah, Gino.
When we talk about justification in Coram Deo, Coram Deo means every time, every moment we stand before the God. What Coram Deo means just the final judgment kind of.
No. It's perpetual, continual, ongoing thing. We stand before God always.
It's justified. Kind of one point every day.
At what?
Just point?
No. Continually. And see, this is the cool thing about getting the symbol, iustus et peccator, right. The key is the symbol at the same time. So when I'm going out in my daily life from, the time I get up until I go to bed at night, cranking through my life, working my tail off, doing my human responsibility things as the best I can, evangelizing, doing my vocation, everything. In every moment that I'm doing that, I am coram Deo, justified, and completely off the hook and forgiven. And what you get then is this wonderful disparity of how the Christian life looks. Because you get people who are knocking themselves out, trying really hard to be good, and at the same time, carefree. And you say, they don't go together. Well, that's the whole beauty of the Christian life, because they do. And see, this actually does speak to some of the things you get about Lutherans. People say, Lutherans, oh, you Lutherans, you're all hung up on guilt. You're always guilt trip. And the other thing you hear is, oh, you Lutherans are a bunch of licentious people. Antinomian licentious, you just live carefree lives. Yeah? They're both true, taken the right way. Because do we live an obsessed life, always worried about, man, I really screwed up, I'm not where I should be, I need to try harder? Well, we should. And at the same time, do we live this kind of a, yeah, I messed up again. Oh, thank goodness for God's grace. Whew, that's really cool. Everything's good. Yeah! I mean, that's it. That's the fun of it. Now, the danger, of course, is falling off on either side. Because you can fall off into getting crazy about working out that salvation and become a pietist and a nutcase. Or you can get crazy about, hey, it's all in the bag, sit back and coast, man, it's all good, and you become an antinomian. And both dangers are there. And so the tension is right there in between. And so what we really should have is these kind of active striving for pious living, which is a holy, good, beautiful Lutheran thing, and at the same time, this rather carefree, liberating freedom that, man, I messed up today. Man, it's too bad. And you really genuinely feel lousy about it, but at the same time, it's all right. I'm still God's child. Good thing I'm forgiven. What a relief. And then you go to bed, happy, lighthearted. Wake up in the morning, it's all good. Is this? How can you beat that? It is like the ideal way of thinking about the Christian life. How can you beat it? Just this complete liberated freedom, and yet at the same time, real insistence on doing the things you're supposed to do. That captures it. And that's kind of what's going on here too. Okay? Thank you, Gino. All right, let's press on in Peeper. So, the center then of everything we do is going to be Article 4, Augsburg Confession, and we use this shorthand. You're familiar with this by now. When I say AC4, what's that stand for? Justification by grace through faith in Jesus Christ alone. the centrality of our teaching. And Pieper goes very hand on this, very, very hard on this, how this go hand in hand and how this is the center of everything. So AC4, which is the idea of forensic justification in Christ. So what Christ has, we get, and what we have, we give to him, the blessed exchange, and that's AC4. Now, 507, Pieper makes an interesting point, and this is one that you guys need to remember. He points out how some people really get a little concerned about the harsh polemic of St. Paul in the book of Philippians, which seems to be out of place with everything else, which is so nice. And Pieper says a very nice thing here. He says, this is the very bottom of 507, last line. Joy over the gracious work of God goes hand in hand with the determination to oppose those who would destroy this joy. Seeing the glorious results of the grace of God in the Philippian congregation, the apostle was moved by holy wrath against the Judaizing workmongers who imperiled the entire foundation of the Christian faith and life. This is exactly what Luther was doing. Remember I told you last time, what gets Luther really fired up? It's the gospel under attack. When the gospel is threatened, Luther goes full blast after you. And that's a good way of being. And you guys need to recognize this in your own life. People have this all the time. Oh, you Lutherans are so hung up. Oh, we're so mean. We're so judgmental. We're so harsh. No, it's an issue of fighting for the truth. And when it's the truth, we proclaim it. And to go against error is actually a zeal for the gospel and a zeal and a love for people. And we need to realize they are not mutually exclusive. So when I criticize false teaching and I do it with zeal, it doesn't mean I'm judgmental and harsh and I hate people. It just means I'm loving God's truth and I want God's truth out there. You need to be sensitive to this because this is a big issue in the world in which we live today, because it has become commonplace in our world to assume that if you say that somebody is going to hell, you therefore hate them. I hear this all the time. And for me, the first time I heard it taught and it was kind of being laid out like a logical thing, I thought, that didn't make any sense. But then I realized they were just taking that for granted. It's like an axiom. And if you pay attention to the rhetoric you hear in the world, this is just assumed all the time. If you actually think that somebody is going to hell and have the temerity to say, I believe he's going to hell because of his teaching, well, then you hate him. And that's what the world assumes. And we need to be a little more articulate in saying, you know, what a person believes is between them and God. And if they believe wrong things, God will hold them accountable. And it doesn't mean that if I say he's got the wrong beliefs and I think he's going to hell, that I hate him. In fact, I could care a lot about him and really love the guy and still think he's going to hell. And we need to be, I think, a little more careful in our Christian teaching to make the difference. Just because I teach, hey, Mormons have the gospel wrong, therefore they are not saved. Well, that means you hate Mormons. No, it doesn't. Any more than I hate Muslims or because they have the gospel wrong and get Christ wrong. And because they get Christ wrong, they have put themselves outside the faith. And you say, well, that's really harsh, outside the faith. Hey, deal with it. John 14, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. Who said that? Oh, yeah, that uptight Jesus guy who was really exclusive and harsh and mean. Hated everybody. Come on. I mean, we got to come clean on this stuff. The zeal for the truth does not mean that we hate people. It means we're zealous for the gospel. And Christ made it very clear. It's exclusive. Christ alone, period. That doesn't mean I hate anybody who's not a Christian. It means I care about them. They need to hear the truth. And if I point out an error in somebody's doctrine, it doesn't mean I hate them. It just means we have a difference in doctrine and it matters. And we can be zealous in fighting against error and fighting for truth without being mean and hating people. But the people in your own congregations aren't going to get this. They struggle with this mightily. They really do. And you need to be, I think, a lot more clear in teaching this. All right, good. Pressing onward. We've already encountered before the distinction, in Luther's mind you should have encountered this, between subjective and objective justification. You remember this distinction? The objective justification distinction is the idea that Christ has objectively, by fact, died for all men. Everybody has been justified. So in a sense, has all of creation been justified at Calvary? Absolutely. Then the subject of justification is the application of that to me, subjectively. And where does that usually take place? Yeah, the baptismal font. When God claims you and puts his name on you, you're mine. Now that's where the subjective happens. So the objective reality of the cross is applied to you subjectively, personally. And so we can make this distinction. It's helpful to do this. It's helpful because it reminds us that God's justification is for all, but why aren't all saved? Well, not all receive the gift and are subjectively justified. So that clarification comes through on page 508 again a little bit. All right, Pieper presses onward and points out how in reality, in the end, both a Roman Catholic emphasis on performance and a Zwinglian or Reformed emphasis on gratia infusa amounts to the same thing. You're missing justification as the bald word of God, and instead you're making it somehow dependent upon what you do, either before or after, and God's performance, or your performance after God's work in your life. And that's a problem. All right, good. Central doctrine. Pieper makes the argument on page 513 and following that justification is the central doctrine of the Christian faith. That's why, you know, AC4, the doctrine on which the church stands or falls. David Scarer is one guy, at least I know, who disagrees. Scarer says all doctrine is Christology. And so he would say, no, it's Christology. Now, before you get all worked up and start having, you know, which one's right, Christology or justification, it's a distinction without a difference when you get right down to it. Because what is justification? It's what Christ has accomplished for us. And what's Christology all about? It's God's work in Christ to do what? To redeem the creation, to justify it, to put things back. And so it's not really that big of a deal of a difference. It kind of is a question of which one you're going to emphasize. And Pieper is even explicit here. He says right on page 514, he spells it out about eight lines down. Thus, Christology serves merely as the substructure of the doctrine of justification. Ouch. That even doesn't sound good. Christology and merely in the same sentence does not sound good. But you get Pieper's point. He's saying we get our Christology right so we can get justification right. But then Scarer would turn around and say, now you get justification right so you can get Christology right because Christ is the center of everything and we want to honor God. I think they're both right. It's just a matter of emphasis on which way you're coming at this. So we don't need to get too worked up about which one that is.
You said that was on 514?
514, yeah.
Yeah.
Like eight lines down.
So I remember reading it. Okay, I got
it's
it.
After the
Thanks.
Brackets of the biblical.
All right, good. Everybody found it. 516, moving on here. Point 5, all Christians believe in justification by faith. This is true. All Christians do. And Pieper writes, there is a great diversity among Christians. Some are strong in their faith, others weak. Some have excellent knowledge of the Christian doctrine. Others are woefully deficient in this respect. There are Orthodox Christians and heterodox Christians, and membership in the Church of Christ are not... But there is full accord among Christians on the doctrine of justification. All Christians are at one in believing that God forgives their sins by grace for Christ's sake without any merit of their own, for it is this faith which makes the Christian. Exactly right. Exactly right. So everybody who is going to be a Christian has to believe in justification by faith through by grace through faith in Jesus Christ alone. Everybody, whether they know it or not. And if you don't believe this, then you are extra ecclesium, which means outside the church. In other words, you ain't Christian. And this gets back to the polemic I was doing before, that we should not be afraid to say, hey, your position puts you outside the church. This is a hot issue now with this whole Mormon thing, which is not going to go away for the next year, at least, as we're dealing with the whole Romney situation. And this comes back again and again and again. Well, you know, Mormons are Christian too. Well, the answer is, no, they're not. They're not. Because of this. If you look at Mormon doctrine, do they say that Christ alone is the means of salvation and that he is sufficient for our standing before God? Do they teach forensic justification? No, they don't. And not only do they miss this, but then they miss the other huge central point, which is the Trinity. So when you get right down to it, you know, the idea of the corpus doctrinae comes back into mind here. You remember hearing about that before, the body of doctrine? So the whole Christian doctrine, all of this is like a body, corpus doctrinae. And it all matters. And it's not like strings pearls on a string where you kind of take them all separately. It all flows together. Doctrine is just one big whole unit called the corpus doctrinae. But there are some parts more important than others. So I can get baptism wrong, lop off an arm. Will I survive? Yeah. Happily? Probably not, but you'll get along. And so someone can get Lord's Supper wrong, lop off another arm. Okay, now we've got an armless person. Can he get by without baptism and Lord's Supper? Probably. Not very happy, but he can. But you can't get by without justification by faith through Christ alone. Forensic justification, AC4, has to be there. Lose that, and you've lost the heart. And the other thing you have to have is Trinity. God is Father, Son, Holy Spirit, the head. You can't have that wrong. You get that wrong, you're out. And so the church has always said that if you get Trinity wrong or if you get justification wrong, you are extra ecclesium, period. It's the way it goes. So it's really not a matter of how nice they are, how many things they agree on, or what their roots are. Who cares? And I even read something recently, which I think is right on the money, that says essentially Mormonism is kind of just like another Abrahamic faith like Islam. And that's the way to think about it. Because does Islam believe in Abraham? Sure. Believe in Jesus? Sure. And essentially what Muhammad is doing is kind of ticked off at some Christians, and so he made up his new faith and kind of did his own freelance. That's what it amounts to. Didn't like what Christians were doing, so he had a new angle with Jesus. It's just what the Mormons do. Do they have Jesus? Sure. He's the guy who's showing us the way to become like God. Great. Okay? But it's not Christian. It's another version of an Abrahamic faith, but it's not Christian. So we got Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Mormonism. That's the way to look at it. It's not Christian. They're extra ecclesium. All right. So any true Christian is going to believe this. This is also true, then, that every true Christian will confess the creed, even if he denies the creed. So you can have a lot of these really sincere, non-denominational, no creeds, just the Bible. Well, in fact, everything in the creed they have to believe, or they're not really a Christian, because it's all from the Bible. You get some funny things here, too. You probably had this when you were doing this in Confessions 1, when you're talking about creeds. You get these weird sort of things where I heard about churches in the Bible Belt wanting to get together, you know, a common stand against the forces of secularism. So these different churches were getting together, the Baptists and the Methodists and the non-denominationals, and they wanted to find some kind of common statement of what they all believed. And so they started putting things together and realized, hey, this creed, yeah, it works pretty good. And they were basically disagreeing to the Apostles' Creed. You know, kind of funny. You know, they eschew these things, and yet they actually, well, yes, we believe. Because that's exactly right. They have to believe these things, so that is the Christian faith, whether they like it or not. All right, good. That's enough on that. Pieper makes a big deal on 516 about the terrores conscientiae, the terrors of conscience, which is just simply the work of the law tearing you down. Then the gospel comes in and gives you life. So you don't need to get too hung up on that. Last thing here, the really significance on 518, this is kind of whetting our appetites where we're heading next time, because the next time we're going to talk a lot more about this, the whole issue of faith and how it is that faith saves. And the key is that faith itself is not what saves. The key thing is the object of faith. That's what matters. This is important because you hear people talk a lot about, oh, so-and-so has so much faith. They're so sincere. And they're such nice people. All those Jehovah's Witnesses, oh, they're really annoying, but they have so much faith. Oh, so much faith. And people say it almost like with admiration. Well, faith is not the point. You can be, as the saying goes, sincere and be sincerely wrong. And so sincerity is nothing. And faith is nothing. The key is the object. And for us, of course, the object is Christ. That's the whole point. So it's not faith per se, it's the faith in Christ. And when you get this right, this starts to shed some light on some interesting things. Faith that is weak or faith that is strong doesn't make that much difference so long as it's hanging on to what saves. And you can come up with analogies which always fall short, but suppose you've got a life raft and you've got a guy who's got both arms hanging on, and he's a big strong guy and he's got a good grip on this. You've got another person who's just barely hanging on, but they're both hanging on that life raft and they're both afloat. And faith is grabbing onto that thing that's going to save them. The object is the same. And once you've got a hold of that object, that's enough. Faith grabs on. We'll talk about this more next time, because I said Pieper's next discussion is going to be talking a lot more about faith. But the point here is it's the object of faith that is significant, not just faith in something or having faith. All right, anything else with Pieper? All right, so far Pieper. We'll pick him up some more next time. Pressing onward then. Next item on the list is this book by Broughton, Justification, the Article by Which the Church Stands or Falls. Did you guys all track this one down all right? I'm hoping you did. Fair enough. Karl Broughton is a name you're going to run across from time to time, and he's often used in conjunction with his good friend, Robert Jensen. And you'll hear about Broughton and Jensen. In fact, Broughton and Jensen together were editors of this systematics textbook, a two-volume series, Christian Dogmatics, or their doctrine book. And it's kind of like the textbook that is used in other seminaries, other Lutheran seminaries. I've mentioned this before because they had different authors do different loci or different articles in the dogmatics. And the one on Christian life was done by Ferdy, for example, and they each did some of their own. But that's Broughton and Jensen. So these guys are ELCA theologians. They weren't ELCA before the ELCA. I think they were both LCA, I believe, Lutheran Church in America. And then they came into the ELCA. But they have always been kind of been perceived as on the right side of things in the ELCA or conservative ELCA theologians. So that's a little bit who they are. Broughton does a lot of work with justification and Christology and the Pannenberg kind of stuff. Jensen tends to do a lot of work with natural law and creation kind of stuff. That's Jensen stuff. And he's written some really helpful stuff. Both of them have written some things that I found have been very helpful and are really very useful. So this book, then, by Broughton comes out in 1990 on justification, the article which the church stands or falls. So that's who Broughton is.
So in this
first chapter, he introduces some concepts which are maybe unique to us, you haven't thought about very much before. But in some circles in the church, it's just stuff that is taken for granted all the time. And it's helpful for you guys just to be aware of some of these other ways of thinking and some of these other ways of defining Lutheranism. Because we live in our own little parochial shell, and sometimes we forget there's a wider community out there. And so he does a nice job of reminding us of this. Now, his opening discussion then, he's really sort of asking the question, where do Lutherans fit today? That's what he's asking. Where do Lutherans fit today? And where this is all going, the big kind of thesis is, where do Lutherans fit? And then he's going to start asking, making the point, what is it that is kind of central to what makes Lutherans Lutherans? Well, it's our teaching on justification. So if we're going to really understand where Lutherans fit, it's going to be in our understanding of justification. And that's what kind of sets the stage for the whole book. That's why he's asking the question. And that's how this kind of holds together. Now, he uses an interesting phrase at the beginning then when he talks about this idea of evangelical Catholics or a confessing movement within Catholicism. You'll hear this sometimes. Now, Lutheranism is a confessing movement within the church. What does that whole thing mean? He talks about this in here, and you should have gotten that out of here, this whole exile thing. What's the basic idea? Anybody?
Basically, he says, describes the Reformation as an exile, where we left so that the church would reform. We wanted reform, but the church wouldn't reform, so we're kind of in exile waiting for them to reform
so
we can come back.
All right. And this is this idea of a confessing movement. And so then the emphasis there is that we're not really a separate church. We're a movement within the church. And we are a protest movement. The mother church was out of whack. Things were wrong. And so we raised a protest, and we're challenging that, and we're here to challenge that mother church until she gets her act together and cleans that up. And then the assumption, of course, is that when she gets her act together, we come back. And so that's kind of this operating assumption that behind this idea of a confessing movement. And there are many within the Lutheran circle who would say, that's right. That gets at it. Now, there are others who would say, no. We are our own church. In fact, we are the true church, and Rome went off the beam, and they're off the whack, and so we're the real church. They need to come back to us. Okay? And you'll get that kind of talk. And then they have no interest in talking about a reconciliation. People need to come back to where we are. And you'll get this way of thinking. Now, is there any value in thinking of it this way?
Well, Luther started thinking that way.
Well, there is evidence in the Reformers that they even talked this way. You know, the idea about it would be enough, the Latin satis est. It's enough if they let us preach the gospel in its purity. And Melanchthon said that. This then leads to things like Richard John Neuhaus, of course. And Neuhaus, graduate of this institution, who ended up going over to Rome. Why? Because he gave up his Lutheran theology and became a Roman Catholic? If you read Neuhaus, he doesn't tell the story that way, does he? How does he see it? They're the church, and I can do my theology there better than I can in my own church, which is probably true because he was the ELCA at the time. But so he believed he had a better environment, and he could go back to Rome without having to repudiate his beliefs or his teaching. And so that's kind of interesting. So in other words, he felt like this is where I need to be, and so he went back. And that becomes a challenge, in a sense, to all of us who are staying out of Rome. And it's a challenge, in a sense, to Broughton. Where does Broughton come down on all of this? Is he ready to jump on Neuhaus's bandwagon?
No, he says that even if that were the case, Rome has not changed itself enough hasn't fixed itself.
All right, this is his point. he's not satisfied there's been enough change yet. And he would say the need for our protest still exists, and Rome hasn't come clean the way they need to yet. Neuhaus made his decision. That's fine. He can go back. For my part, Broughton says, they're not where they need to be yet. I think we need to keep on standing apart for the sake of the church and for the proclamation of the church. And that's where Broughton comes down. Obviously, I would say I'm probably more sympathetic to Broughton's position than I am to Neuhaus on this. But you've got to, at least I would say, I have respect for a guy like Neuhaus. I've read enough of his stuff to know he's not a, you know, kind of a lightweight. And I, when he makes a challenge like that, it's worth thinking about. But I think Broughton comes down in the right place that, no, there is this responsibility that we have. And even if we don't buy completely into this idea of a confessing movement that someday we're just going to all go back to Rome, what this reminds us of is there is definitely a relationship that we have with Rome. And there should be this sense of a sympathetic attitude towards Rome. After all, that's kind of Mother Church, and we recognize that. And in error, all right, but we really wanted to get right because we would love to see unity. See, that ecumenical drive is not wrong. Just because something is ecumenical doesn't mean, uh-oh, that's liberal. No, there should be in all of this, this urge and this desire for unity, this true ecumenism. That's a good thing. Now, the other thing that you get, which is a hallmark of a lot of these guys' theology, and Broughton is no exception, is a stress on the ecumenical aspect of things. The idea of unity, unity, unity. And again, coming from our background, this has not been as central a concern for us. We kind of see this with a little bit of skepticism or downright fear, and we worry about the ecumenical stuff, and we tend not to be very interested. Whereas most of the people in the ELCA, this is the end of everything. Oh, man, unity, unity, unity at any cost, and we see them making these rather odd alliances and hopping into their ecumenical bed with just about anybody who comes down the road and says, hey, we'll join you. All right. And we get a little concerned about that. But this is a driving concern much more to a lot of our friends in the ELCA than it is to us, and Broughton falls into that camp as well. Very much concerned about the ecumenical aspect of things. And sometimes to the point of sacrificing stuff. To his credit, I don't see Broughton sacrificing the doctrine of justification for ecumenical purposes. He's saying, in fact, if we want to really get our ecumenical stuff right, we've got to deal with justification because it's so central, and we've got to deal with it honestly. So that's what the position he takes. All right, good. So this is kind of the first things he's talking about. Another aspect that comes into play here, this is page 9. Ecclesia. The Ecclesia Semper Reforma. Nope. Make sure I spell it right for you. Yeah, okay. Thought so. Ecclesia Semper Reformanda. Which means the church is always reforming. The church is always reforming. What you often see coming from some of our friends on the left side of things is that they say, what is it that makes a Lutheran? And a lot of them will say this, Ecclesia Semper Reformanda. What did Luther do? He reformed the church. What do Lutherans do? They reformed the church. And this then becomes an excuse for just this kind of ongoing, continual reformation of the church. And then you can open up all kinds of interesting avenues here. Like, what do we do as the church? Well, we are always challenging the church and always pushing forward. So we should be ordaining women. And we should be ordaining homosexuals and blessing same-sex unions because, see, we are continually challenging the church to be more like the gospel. And this is interesting because this is why some of the people that we would say are totally selling out the faith look at us as being totally selling out the faith because we're missing this and we're not doing this. And they see themselves as actually being faithful in their work.
So. Yeah, I've heard this argument before that like the ELCA capture the spirit of Luther.
Exactly.
That they're the spirit and we are kind of like, you know, the historical setting.
Oh, yeah, we're hung up in historicism. We're doing repristination stuff. We're totally irrelevant because we've missed the real spirit of Lutheranism. And in fact, they insist that if Luther would come back today and walk around, he would bless what they're doing and curse us.
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, my argument is, was the spirit of Luther to reform for reform's sake, or was the spirit of Luther to stand on truth?
No, this is exactly right. This is exactly how we respond to this. But now, what's interesting, though, and see, this is helpful to remember, is people in your own parish are going to say, how can they call themselves Lutheran? Look what they're doing. And they kind of assume that some of these people get up and they just want to ruin the church. You know, how can I screw the church up today? Oh, I know, I'm going to fight for gay rights. And that's not what's going on. These people are sincerely devoted to their causes because they think they're being right. They think they're being faithful to the gospel. They think they're being faithful to Luther. And that's why the issues are much more fundamental, like what's it mean to be a Lutheran? What's it mean to be faithful? And our response, you're exactly right, Doug, is essentially, hey, Luther didn't reform just for the sake of Reformation. That's very clear. He was reforming only to the extent he needed to, which is one of the reasons why he does not go cleansing everything out, but holding on to what is good and trying to be balanced in what he's doing, because the truth is what matters. And if you especially look at Luther fully mature in the 1530s, that comes through very clearly. And this is also why a lot of those who hold to this position look at mature Luther as a sellout and kind of, he got crotchety and crabby in his old age, and his intestinal problems got the better of him and he became crabby. And then they kind of just write him off. And we'd say, no, that's the real Luther. All right, good.
It's not just the LCA that does that too. It's mostly evangelicalism.
Yes. That's correct. You see these same motifs at work in the wider church. It's still going on. It's all over the place. That's right. And so we need to kind of know where we position ourselves in this whole discussion. That's quite right. And it's not just evangelicalism and ELCA. It's also in our own church body. Yes. All right. Good. So this then leads to what he talks about in here, that we have now in the 20th century increasingly a concern more and more, less on soteriology, how we're saved, and more on ecclesiology. See, this gets into the whole ecumenical confessing movement thing. So we're saying that, questions of soteriology aren't nearly as important as questions of ecclesiology, and that's sort of where we have come as a church-wide kind of discussion. Braun's position, page 10, summarizes it up very nicely. This study of justification will call into question the shift in focus from soteriology to ecclesiology. It may be that such a shift only moves the emphasis from one kind of narcissism to another, namely, from the individualistic question, how can I find a gracious God, to an ecclesiocentric concern with self-gratifying status and power. Ouch. I think he's right. Is not the question of salvation still the most serious question that people are asking? He's going to come back to this issue in the next chapter. Christ comes before the church. Our relation to the church is mediated by our relation to Christ, although the church is necessary in mediating that very relationship. This is not an either-or, or it is a matter of priority. The solus Christus, in which the article of justification is grounded, makes that clear. So in other words, what he is saying is there's no debate here between soteriology and ecclesiology, and in fact, soteriology is primary, and then ecclesiology. Now, there's clearly correspondence. The church is what mediates the gospel to us and brings Christ, but ultimately, the relationship we have with Christ is first. All right, the next part of the chapter is where he goes into this kind of review of the history of the 20th century. And as I said, if you're planning to do grad work around here, you'll become very familiar with this whole story, and it becomes important to you. If you're not, it's not that relevant. It's just this whole list of these people he's talking about. But the interesting thing is on page 12, where he talks about three forces that have been at work in the church today to bring us to where we are now. This is very interesting. Central paragraph on page 12, about halfway through. He writes, in Protestant orthodoxy, justification tended to become petrified in a system of scholastic categories enshrined in the coffin of pure doctrine. Who's he have in mind there? Thank you. Exactly. Us. Now, not just us, but clearly he would put us in that category. So in other words, we're so concerned about pure doctrine that we petrify the whole system of justification and we enshrine it in a coffin. And so, wow, pretty strong language here, and you can see what he thinks of that. But now, is that a fair criticism? And probably. There are times when we become so concerned about doctrinal fidelity and getting it right that we actually forget about how it applies, forget about proclaiming it. This is back to that concern that Thomas Long had. Remember his essay? That you don't make forensic justification into a series of doctrines, but you preach it. You actually need to deliver it. You do it. And there's something to be said for this. He's got a point here. So that's his first problem. Second problem. In pietism, the focus was on the individual's experience of repentance and faith, justification being one aspect of the way of salvation, along with regeneration, the pursuit of holiness. So we have an individualization. Third, the Enlightenment. My problem. In the Enlightenment, religion became a private affair, divorced from the worldwide dominion of God in all expressions of life. So now he says this. These three trends in Protestant Christianity have been described as a modern Babylonian captivity of the church, following Luther, with crippling effects on the doctrine of justification because of its doctrinal objectivization in Protestant orthodoxy. We just kind of objectify it. In other words, this becomes a mere doctrinal, scholastic, intellectual exercise apart from me. This is Ferdy's concern, that if we make justification something that happens over there, then I'm never really killed and made alive. And so it becomes very sterile. That's one thing that happens. The second thing that happens is it's individualization in pietism. It's all about me. I don't need a church. I don't need a community. I'll just read the Bible by myself. Me and Jesus, thank you very much. So I go off and have my quiet time. A little bit what you get in Campus Crusade kind of stuff. You know, the evangelical, radical me getting saved, your personal salvation, and who needs the church? What's the church anyway? You know, a little accountability group maybe, but what else? Then the third thing is, it's privatization, enlightenment, rationalism, and this is the sense that religion is merely a private affair and has no bearing on a wider public, and it has nothing to say to the world around us. So these three things, he said, have tended to all come together to make justification seem irrelevant and no longer important. And he's going to try to undo that whole thing. That's his discussion. All right, he talks about Hall and Harnack, and this is the question that John had earlier, as two different ways of thinking about justification. Hall was making it essentially into a sense of saving the society, the sanative justification. We become holy in our actions. And Harnack was saying, no, it's more about the forensic and how LWF is kind of sort these things out. And so then he talks about Ferdy a little bit, which is very nice. And wraps things up in this chapter, page 18. There is no end to all the conceivable questions. We shall have to keep the most important of them in mind as we look at justification afresh. Does justification make sense anthropologically under the conditions of modern experience and knowledge and in light of understanding the world and ourselves? Does justification help or hinder the interconfessional dialogues aiming to reunify world Christianity? There's this ecumenical drive. Or is it merely a game that Lutherans may be allowed to play at home as long as they don't impose its rules on their ecumenical journey? So go do your thing, just leave us alone. Does justification provide ethical motivation, inspiring people to fight for justice and peace, or does it put us to sleep on our quietistic beds? And it can do either way, depending on how you look at it. We're saved, don't worry about it, like I was talking about before. Do we have to be doctrinally synergistic to be ethically responsible? All right, so this is his introductory chapter, and he kind of sets the stage for everything that follows. Questions you have from this chapter, things you want to explore further. John had one earlier, which is great. You got questions about individuals or what he's saying or arguing, fire away. Bottom line of this chapter is he's saying, guess what? Justification still matters. It's still relevant. It's still important, and Lutherans need to be paying attention to this discussion. It's part of what makes us who we are, and we have a responsibility to the wider church to be faithful in this discussion. That's really what he's saying. All right, let's go to chapter 5, the next chapter you are to read for today. So now he's going to ask the question in here, the gospel of justifying grace and justifying faith. And the question is, how does this actually work in the world today? Page 82, the bottom half of that page, right in the middle of that page, Broughton writes, "The state of being righteous in the sight of God is radically a free gift of grace, never the result of human achievement." Right on. "Faith itself comes of the Spirit of God." That's right, too. "To say that faith is reckoned as righteousness apart from the works of the law underscores the absolute gratuitousness of God's generosity. God gives what he demands, both the righteousness and the faith by which it is grasped." Amen. Divine monergism. Got it. I mean, that's spot on. In essence, this was the message that turned things around for Luther and his followers. Justification by grace alone, through faith alone, on account of Christ alone, is the absolute truth by which the church stands or falls. It is this truth that makes Christianity Christian and the church really the church, preserving it from idolatry, preventing its secularization, providing the charter of its career, and offering believers a solid basis and direction for their daily life. The doctrine of justification was the doctrine of doctrines, not one among many. It functioned as a critical principle, cleansing the church of everything that enters into contradiction with the evangelical basis and content of faith. What's there to disagree with? I mean, nothing. That is clear explication of justification, its centrality, its dynamic living reality. All right. Now, having said that, he introduces the issue that increasingly in the 20th century and still today in the 21st century, people have suggested and argued that justification is no longer a relevant question. Justification is no longer a relevant question. What is meant when that is argued? Why would somebody say that justification doesn't matter anymore? Have you heard this said? Why would somebody say this? Why would somebody suggest that maybe justification is not relevant anymore? Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe it's not a big deal anymore. Yeah?
Because people don't have a sense of internal struggle. They don't feel the fact that they need to be justified.
Okay.
They've self-justified themselves for so long that they don't feel there's an accountability to God.
All right. Good. Joshua, you got your hand.
I mean, I feel like there could be some complacency that just people think that, well, it's just
people just know it, so we don't really argue about it too much anymore. And so.
All right. The basic message of the Christian faith, maybe people are, we assume everybody knows, so we don't talk about it, so we can't take it for granted. And then the other sense that Brett is picking up, go ahead. You're going to follow up on that? Okay. The sense that Brett brought up is this idea that we just don't feel this kind of angst anymore. When was the last time you were talking to somebody and they said, oh, man, I just don't know where I stand with God. I'm really concerned about my relationship with God because I don't think I'm in the right standing with God. These are not the kinds of questions people ask. I mean, your college friends, were they all beat up over where they stood with God? Is that really concerning them? I'm willing to bet most of them probably not. And so that becomes the point. And I've heard this argued from good conservative people saying, oh, man, the church has to kind of nuance its message because justification is not relevant anymore. And that's good said. And they say, in Luther's day, it was different. Because in the 16th century, everybody was obsessed with the question of justification. And Broughton says the same. At the time of the Reformation, this is page 83, the doctrine of justification was the concern of every Christian, whether the farmer at the plow, artisan in the shop, servant in the house, scholar in the study, or the lawyer pleading a case in court. Everybody was concerned about this because everybody was wondering, where do I stand with God? There's a holy God. Nobody doubted that. They knew that they were not holy people. They knew that God demanded holiness, so they had a big problem. How do I get right with this holy God? How do I know where I stand? And so these were big questions. Luther exemplifies this. Why does Luther join the monastery? Yeah. I mean, in spite of all of his sham vow to St. Anne and his excuse to join the monastery, the real driving concern for Luther is, hey, I want to make sure I'm right with God, and going to law school is not getting the deal, not getting the job done. And if I'm going to get serious about being right with God, I've got to join a monastery. So he did, because he needed to know he was right with God. And it was not just the concern of Luther. Most people were concerned about, where do you stand with God? What do you think was driving the indulgence sales? Why were people so running off to relics and stuff all the time? Because they were concerned about where they stood with God. Hell scared them.